A BYD está com ofertas para você levar um elétrico ou híbrido novinho para a sua garagem. Vá a uma concessionária e faça um test drive. BYD, construa seus sonhos.
Bem-vindos. Hoje, enquanto o mundo assiste à guerra, que pode se tornar a maior na Europa desde 1945, na Rússia, sob censura, a mídia estatal informa que não há guerra, que as cidades de Kiev, Kharkiv e Mariupol não estão sendo destruídas, que o que ocorre é apenas uma operação militar especial humanitária. Todos temiam, pouca gente acreditava, mas veio. Vladimir Putin invadiu a Ucrânia, fiel à tradição imperialista russa. Nosso convidado de hoje nunca deixou de alertar para os desígnios de Putin. Fala com autoridade sobre o presente da Rússia por conhecer em profundidade seu passado. Aliás, até Vladimir Putin, para conhecer a história do príncipe Potemkin e da imperatriz Catarina, que primeiro anexaram a Crimeia no século XVIII, recorreu a um livro dele. E como ele escreve bem, sabe tornar a história viva e assim revela as pontes entre passado e futuro por onde marcha a esfinge de Vladimir Putin. Ele sabe que o autocrata padece de uma obsessão central. Ele sabe que a primeira pergunta que Putin faz quando encontra um historiador é: como a história irá me julgar? Vamos especular sobre possíveis respostas com um dos maiores conhecedores da história e da alma russas, o historiador e escritor inglês Simon Sebag Montefiore. Thank you very much for this opportunity, Mr. Montefiore.
Nice to see you.
Listen, Simon, last time you were in Russia, I hear it was in 2018. Were there any indications that Putin could follow on this kind of plans as an invasion, a real invasion?
I mean, I think it was always on the cards, in the sense that his entire career has been built on a rising momentum of violence. I mean, I think the real signs, you know, are in Syria and also in Chechnya. I think, interestingly, by the way, I mean, I think had he invaded in 2014, he might well have got away with this in a way that is impossible now. I mean, partly because in 2014, you know, he had a much more legitimate pretext in the overthrow of the extremely horrible but properly legitimately elected president Yanukovych, and I think ever since then he's regretted that he didn't do it then.
Do you agree that the invasion of Ukraine was Vladimir Putin's greatest miscalculation? Why?
Yeah, I think so, probably. I think it probably was a massive miscalculation. I think he's extremely isolated in his entourage. I think he's spent 2 years almost on his own with his bodyguards, talking to very few people. I think he's misinformed by his security people, his intelligence people. And I think when you have a czar or an emperor that doesn't really welcome the truth and doesn't welcome good advice, he doesn't receive it. And so that's what's happened here. I think, as I said, I think, you know, 8 years ago in 2013-14, had he invaded, he might well have succeeded. But his own actions have helped consolidate Ukrainian consciousness, Ukrainian patriotism, and more than anything, and this is very important, Ukrainian military power, which is now surprisingly impressive. And after all, you've got to remember, Ukraine's a massive country. I mean, it's 40 million people. So, you know, their military may not have the high-tech thermobaric weapons, of course, chemical and technical and nuclear weapons, but it does have a pretty large army.
But another thing that might have stimulated, made Putin believe that he could get away with the invasion, is something that you already said, that Putin benefited from the West's self-hatred. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the West has been in a state in the last 10 years of incredible self-indulgence, self-examination, self-loathing. And I think that this is one of the things that we know that Putin regards as a terrific weakness. He despises it, in fact. He constantly talks about it. Even today, he was talking about cancel culture in the West. And that is one of the things that he felt showed that the West was decadent, as well as hypocritical. He believes the West is moralistic and hypocritical. And that's one of the aspects that he regards as a great weakness. To add to that, you have to factor in several other things. Donald Trump, he was kind of, I think, slightly afraid of. Donald Trump was very unpredictable. And unpredictability in a game of Russian roulette is a useful characteristic to have. But I think he thinks that Biden provided a key opportunity. He was weak. He's woolly. He's slightly verbose. And I think the Afghan withdrawal would have been a huge factor in him deciding to do this. Let's face it, it was a disaster for Western prestige, especially for American prestige. On top of that, I think you have the crisis in NATO, the EU Brexit, the Brexit with England, which really removed from the European Union the most powerful European country with Germany. So all of these meant that I think he regarded this as a unique opportunity, plus the fact that he's getting old and he's almost 70 years old. So I think he thought, like, it's now or never.
What kind of identitarian is Vladimir Putin?
I think he's an ultra-nationalist. And I think he's best understood looking at the 19th century, particularly looking at the Slavophiles in the 19th century. Some of the whites in the Russian Civil War who talked about the Russian space, the Russian soul, the Russian world as an exceptionalist, Russian-speaking, orthodox world that was not only different from the West, not only distinct, but vastly superior. And I think he's embraced that. And that's a huge difference with the Marxists like Lenin and Stalin who came before him, because they believed in an internationalist Marxist crusade, a mission to convert the world. Well, he is really attached to a unification of what he sees as the Russian world, the Slavic peoples, the Russian-speaking peoples. So he's an ultra-nationalist, and that's a break with the past. I mean, it was amazing, and I'm sure it was amazing for Russians when he attacked Lenin in that first speech just before the invasion. That was extraordinary.
It's always very hard to forecast any movements in the maze of Russian power corridors, and it's always a guess game. But with the war dragging on, Putin will become more and more Stalinist, sliding from authoritarian rule to a totalitarian regime.
I think that's right. I mean, I think if you look at what's happened in Russia in the last 20 years, you know, he started as a sort of liberal, or he was playing that role. Then he moved very much to authoritarian. And during the last 5 or 7 years, he's been shutting down organizations and institutions of what we call civil society. He's been persecuting historians. He's been persecuting the Memorial organization that studies the history of the Stalin terror, for example. And so it started a lot earlier, but you're right. I mean, in the last month, it's intensified, it's accelerated, and you know he's closed down all press. He's closed down Google. He's closed down the independent radio station Echo, and you know he's now started to use the expressions of the Stalinist terror in 1937. You know, he's calling people bastards, scum, traitors, enemies of the people. He's talking about purges, cleansings. So this is very alarming. And for Russians, of course, it's especially frightening because these words, you know, don't mean so much to us in England or Brazil, but they mean a lot They mean a lot to Russians.
Yeah, they bring memories. Listen, this is the 1 million rubles question. What are the chances of a coup d'etat against Putin?
You know, it's very easy for us to be optimistic, and there's a lot of wishful thinking here. I mean, of course, there's a real tradition of palace coups in Russia. There is a possibility, but actually, in recent times, this has been very rare. There are very few Russian revolutions. Virtually no one is overthrown in Russian history in a popular demonstrations. Only really Nicholas II in 1917, February 1917.
February.
And that, yeah, and that was when generals really removed him. So the military and the security services are the only hope here. And the likelihood is, after 20 years, that they are absolutely filled with sycophants and protégés of Vladimir Putin.
Agora vamos ouvir o Vladimir Putin falando sobre Stalin para o Oliver Stone, um documentário que Stone gravou durante 2 anos e que tem 4 horas de duração, um documento importantíssimo, muito interessante. Vamos ouvir um trecho.
Сталин был продуктом своей эпохи. Можно сколько угодно его демонизировать и сколько угодно, с другой стороны, говорить о его заслугах в победе над нацизмом. Мне кажется, что излишняя демонизация Сталина – это один из способов, один из путей атаки на Советский Союз и на Россию. Вот. Показать, что сегодняшняя Россия несет на себе какие-то родимые пятна сталинизма. Мы все несем какие-то родимые пятна. Ну и что? Просто я к чему хочу сказать это? Потому что Россия капитально изменилась. Конечно, наверное, что-то в сознании чего-то остается. Но это не значит, что мы должны забыть все ужасы сталинизма, связанные с концлагерями и уничтожением миллионов своих соотечественников. Поэтому это сложная фигура в конце жизни, я думаю, что...
Fascinating conversation, that, isn't it?
Incredible. Do you think that contradicting the famous sentence of Solzhenitsyn, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Putin could be more dangerous than Stalin precisely because he does not have an ideology?
Well, I think he has an ideology, which I think is this ultra-nationalism, this Russian world, he calls it. But I think that I think he is more dangerous than Stalin internationally. I think one of the strange things about Stalin, I mean, Stalin was a complete monster. You know, he achieved astonishing things, but at an unbearable cost in blood and people, a human cost. But Stalin, in international affairs, was really quite cautious. For example, I mean, he only invaded Finland in 39-40 because he had an agreement with Hitler to divide up Europe. He never took a gamble like this internationally. And I think he'd seen after the Second World War, even though he expected one day for there to be war between the capitalists and the Marxists of the Soviet Union, I think he was pretty cautious about nuclear war. And I think that Putin here has taken, in a way, a major gamble that Stalin didn't take.
What remains of Stalinism in Russian society and culture?
Well, I don't think there's much Marxism now, except among very old people. But what's interesting, and it's a very good question, because it's the key, that is the million ruble question, I think, as well, which is the Stalin state, I mean, Stalin created the Russian state. Putin is sitting in Stalin's office. Stalin created the Soviet Union that Putin revered. Stalin was the greatest Russian imperialist in many ways. He also created, really, the secret police apparatus. And, you know, that was never dismantled in 1991. The West naively believed that it had been dismantled, but actually it never was. You know, it was just dormant. And you had all these people in the Chekhas, they call it in Russia, who deeply resented the humiliation of the Soviet Union, the humiliation of Russia. So, you know, really, Putin just has to reactivate this kind of repressive Stalinist state. And of course, the Russian presidency is way too powerful in the state. It really is very like the general secretaryship of Stalin or the later Soviet leaders. So the Stalin apparatus is there.
O que se sabe é que Putin leu o livro de Simon Montefiore, Catarina Grande e Potemkin, Uma História de Amor na Corte Romanov. Esse casal comandou a Rússia entre 1762 e 1796. E eles foram os primeiros a anexar a Crimeia e muito, uma grande parte da Ucrânia. How did you get to know Putin has read your book?
It was an interesting situation. That was the first book I wrote in Russia. And after I read it, it was just around the time of the meeting between the first visit of George W. Bush to St. Petersburg. And when he arrived, when he was coming to St. Petersburg, he and George W. Bush announced that he was reading the book with his wife, and they were reading the part of Catherine and Potemkin, which is kind of hilarious. When he arrived at the Winter Palace, he was greeted by Putin, and he said, Putin said, would you like to see a portrait of Peter the Great? And he said, no, I'd like to see Prince Potemkin. And Putin said, I know this book.
Vamos assistir a algumas imagens da Rússia num dia qualquer comum em Moscou.
Os ativistas, вообще.
Вы за активистов?
За активистов, конечно.
Я просто хотела спросить, как вы думаете, если здесь просто сказать два слова, меня за это сейчас арестуют или нет?
Вас уже задерживают. С ума сойти. С ума сойти.
Молодец. Да, молодец.
На каком основании?
Putting on shows of force, of strength like this, is Putin abiding to Peter Stolypin's advice? In Russia, nothing is more dangerous than the appearance of weakness.
Yeah, I mean, of course he is. His policy now is like he cannot afford a single example of weakness within Russia. And these, you know, I want to say actually that, you know, one has to pay tribute to these people. Of course, there are many Russians that support this war. There are many Russians that are, that in every dictatorship, I think one has to remember, because one often says, you know, is Putin, people often ask me, is Putin mad? By the way, I don't think he's mad. Maybe we want to discuss that later, but I mean, these regimes are held together by hundreds of thousands of people, who judges and generals and policemen and officials. And, you know, it's never a one-man regime. But I do think that the courage shown by these Russians who are protesting, you know, it's very easy for us to criticize Russians from our safe homes in Brazil or London. But actually, these people are showing real courage. I mean, not as much courage as Ukrainians who are fighting in the streets of their cities, but huge courage, which we can't even imagine. I mean, they're risking everything. You know, they could lose their houses, their jobs, their families. They could go to prison. So, you know, we must acknowledge and salute these people.
Talking about Putin's supposed madness, I tend to agree with you when you say that we, from the West, we call mad the guys that we don't understand, that we don't have a grasp of. But perhaps he's getting crazy, but perhaps he's going crazy now.
Well, I think you've obviously got to have a very different mental world view to launch an invasion of a country like this. But I think as a historian, my whole job is always just to try and get into the mind of the other people, even if they're extremely evil people. So, you know, I think he sees Ukraine as British imperialists used to see Ireland or Scotland. And he just sees it as, you know, essential to the Russian state. But it is chilling to watch. It must be chilling for Latin Americans, but it's very chilling for us too.
Simon mora em Londres e depois de várias aventuras, digamos assim, profissionais, inclusive como correspondente de guerra nessa área da Europa e da antiga União Soviética, ele se tornou historiador, escritor e, mais que especializado, ele é apaixonado pela Rússia. I was telling our audience that there's a kind of passion. You have a passion about Russia. Where does it come from? It runs in your veins?
I think so, because my mother's family all come from Russia. Some come from Lithuania in the north, and some come from Odessa in the south. So there's a real connection between these places. And, you know, the family came in different waves after the pogroms in 1903 and 1881. And so, yeah, there's always been a Russian fascination within the family, actually. And in 1991, I was very lucky because the Soviet Union broke up. I was actually a banker, believe it or not, in London, in New York at that time. And I immediately just went to the Soviet Union, the disintegrating Soviet Union. And I was very lucky. I saw everything that was happening. I saw the breakup of the empire in person.
I must tell you that I was a correspondent for 8 years in Europe, and by complete chance, I arrived for the first time in the Soviet Union in Moscow on the Sunday, 18th of August, 1991. Next day, good timing. I woke up, nobody gets in, nobody gets out, and I didn't have an accreditation, so I went to the streets, and suddenly I saw Yeltsin climbing up a tank and armored cars, and it was the highest point of my correspondent career. It was incredible.
Amazing.
Simon, you tell us that whenever Putin meets historians, he asks, how will history judge me? Any hint?
Well, I don't think it's going very well, if that's what you mean. I mean, this is a major miscalculation. I mean, essentially, he totally misunderstood what has happened in Ukraine in the last 20 years, which is that it's become, you know, a fully fledged patriotic nation. And he is existing, you know, at an earlier time when it was a Soviet republic, and that's how he thinks of it, and a Russian province, a Russian region. So I think that he's totally miscalculated in that sense. But of course, he is obsessed with history. He lives history now. And every czar and commander and sort of general secretary and Russian ruler afterwards, you know, really, really aspires to command in war, to win a war. And they're now calling Putin, you know, supreme commander in the press in Russia.
So finally, what did Catherine the Great do in the 18th century that Maria I, the Queen of Portugal, did not?
She vaccinated her children. She welcomed one of the pioneers of smallpox vaccination, Dr. Dimmesdale, an Englishman, to Petersburg, and she vaccinated herself and her son Paul, and which was, you know, regarded at the time as extremely brave and pioneering, and shows us, you know, an example of how important vaccination is and how important it remains today. So she was ahead of a lot of things. She was a really amazing person, Catherine the Great, actually.
Agora eu conto a parte de Portugal. Maria I não quis vacinar seus filhos contra a varíola. O seu primogênito, herdeiro do trono, José I, morreu de varíola. Assumiu o trono Dom João VI. E o resto da história nós brasileiros sabemos. Que diferença faz uma vacina, hein? What a difference a vaccine makes. Mr. Montefiore, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. I hope one day we have the chance of meeting in person.
I'm coming to Brazil sometime, because my next book, I'm going to come and I'm going to launch it. And I love coming to the festivals, and I love Brazilians.
Great. So then we'll have another show, put another show on when you come to Brazil next time.
I'm coming and I can't wait.
Thank you so much. Até a próxima, gente.
Gostou da conversa? No Globoplay você pode acompanhar e também ver as imagens de tudo que rolou.